Going to hit record before we talk about safe words too much more. This is episode 5 of season 12 of Mention and Dispatches. Welcome back, fans and friends and fiends, if we got any of them listening also. We've brought back a you know, well-traveled classic voice and a brand new voice to this episode. And so we've got Mo back with us and Mo's first appearance this season. And I think we only had you on like one time last season too, didn't we?
I think so. And what the hell is the safe word that we're going to be using? Not the password, you know, but the safe word, being that that was something we talked about beforehand. So I figured to throw it in.
We're going to let the audience speculate in the comments. I'm just sort of curious if they can identify the safe word without us calling it out ahead of time. All right. We'll see what they come up with.
Exactly.
Lord knows we've got some creative audience. The brand new voice, you know, for this season of the podcast, you know him through social media as Molotov Cockatiel. Bill is here to join us. Bill, how you doing tonight?
Not too bad. How's it going?
I think we're all doing okay. I haven't checked the score of the Canes game. They were losing when I came up here, which was a bit of a bummer. But it does lead to a question I've got for Mo. Mo, this is a non-war game question. This goes back to your other gig of being a hockey dude. What is your favorite, like, arena tune when, you know, to play between the action and the hockey games? I know you don't hit play on the tunes, but your favorite one to blast out through the arena?
Probably Warriors Call by Volbeat or anything Metallica. You know, yeah. Those two right there definitely get the blood pumping.
Yeah. I was thinking about it when I saw, I was channel surfing the other day and it was a different hockey game. There wasn't much else on. So I just left it on that. I want to say it was the Blues and somebody, but I don't hold me to that. And in between the action, the opening riff for Sweet Leaf came on from Black Sabbath. And nice. And I think that is an all-time banger of a riff for between the action of the sports event there.
Really? So, they played Sweet Leaf?
Yes.
Oh, just man. They're like going way back into classics.
Ultra heavy opening. Well, I mean, you get Iron Man and Paranoid all the time, but it's sure. Kind of cool that they busted out Sweet Leaf. I'm always awesome. Astounded when they bust out a Dio riff, right? And they start playing Holy Diver or Rainbow in the Dark.
Yeah, that would be cool too.
Those are off the wall. So, Bill, I don't know how much you hang out at any sports events. If you've got an opinion here, feel free to jump in.
Celtics are my team of choice. Celtics and Pacers, I guess. If hockey, if I had to choose Bruins, you guys probably hate them. I grew up, you know, watching Larry Bird, so that stuck.
Yeah, I don't hate the Bruins in general. I hate Brad Marchand in particular.
Mm-hmm. Like, I think even Boston hates Brad Marchand. Nah, he's great at what he does.
Yeah, I can see him being not liked. He's one of those guys you're glad he's on your team because you would hate him on any other team. Yeah,
he's an instigator. Yeah. He gets under players' skin. He tries drawing penalties, getting you off your game. He does his job perfectly, and that's what his role is on the team. And he unfortunately he kind of hides. Not hides, but it kind of overshadows his playing ability because people forget he's a damn good player.
Yep. The previous generation, that was Michael Pekka, I think, was the was Brad Marchand before Brad Marchand.
And one of my favorites in that, you want to go back a little further, one of my favorites in that role was Kenny Linsman, the Rat from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
He was great for that, just getting under people's skin.
Yeah. Plus, you got Tom Wilson running around out there. Anytime Tom Wilson is running around out there, you've got an absolute jerk that everybody can hate out there on the ice somewhere. So
true.
I'm sure the audience didn't come to hear us talk about hockey goons, though. So, you know, I mean, it's not like we couldn't go on hockey for a while, particularly with Mo here. But
well, there's hockey. The hockey's got some warfare involved in it, you know, one-on-one fisticuffs.
And
although they're really cutting back on that.
There's a big crossover.
Published as a hockey game. So,
yeah.
I've noticed there are a lot of hockey fans in wargaming. I don't know if it's the Canadian factor. There's a lot of wargamers in Canada. I don't know. Someone should do a Venn diagram of all these things and put them all together.
Having a conversation about hockey with Mo, I managed to learn something. So that helps too.
Well, it was just 5 days ago that a pretty cool hockey game happened 44 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
US beat the Soviets.
And it's funny because everybody says, oh, yeah, I remember watching that live. No, you didn't.
I did. Well, not live. It was on tape delay.
It was on tape delay.
Because it was a couple hours later. They played it at, I think, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They showed it like 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. So it was after the fact.
You might have watched the broadcast when it originally aired, but you didn't watch the game live unless you were in Lake Placid.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely watched it. I watched the first playing of it live on television, yes. not live. It was already over at that point, but still it was a cool game.
Still an all-time goosebumps moment to hear the call.
Yeah, Al Michaels knocked it out of the park on that one.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. All right, wargaming stuff.
I thought we were going to talk hockey all night.
Look, we could, but I'm not sure that's why the audience tuned in.
This is a wargame podcast. What are we doing talking about hockey? That's what everybody's looking at the radio going, see, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
To the damn wargame.
So one of the things I wanted to do and was trying to bring in two viewpoints of varying experience here. I wanted to go back to talking about some classic wargames and talking about some of the old school stuff, some of the original Avalon Hill stuff that even predates SPI, as well as going back to some of the old SPI and GDW classics. And I've got kind of two minds on this a little bit. One is, it is a little painful that you can go register a car with a classic car license plate that is 25 years old, and that's well into the 90s and about to be the 2000s. So our definition of classic probably needs to get redefined a little older than that. So we probably need to go back, like, you know, to the 70s and maybe cut it off somewhere around 82-ish, maybe. I'm not really sure. We'll discuss it as we go, but the definition of classic as the years roll on, the definition of classic starts to include more and more things that we were contemporary with, and I think that's a little scary. But the other thing, to bring in a total non-wargame analogy here, one of the things that a friend of mine once said about the music business, I think applies a little bit to the wargaming world as well. Not music business, but music fandom. And that is, when you discover kind of an artist who's in the middle of their career but has a track record before you get to them, you often find that all the stuff before you discovered them, like right when you glommed onto them and older, those are all the really cool things. And all the stuff after that is kind of crap. And that's sort of how you view it. And the example that he used was always Tom Petty, right? Everything before Full Moon Fever was really good. Everything after Full Moon Fever was kind of crap. Because that's when he sort of found Tom Petty and started to really dig into the catalog and become a fan of his. Same thing with Bruce Springsteen. Everything before Born in the USA, that's all awesome stuff. Everything after that, it's crap. And so does that apply to wargaming also? Like, all of the classics, all of those really cool uber classics are all the ones before you got to be like really immersed in the hobby, and everything after that is crap. I don't really think that necessarily applies, but it's a theory that we can explore.
You mean as in like newer stuff, or after, meaning previous?
No, the newer stuff.
Okay.
Like the old stuff is all the really cool classic. Yeah, this is awesome. Whereas the newer stuff is kind of like, maybe not so much. So Mo, do you want to tackle like the music comparison, or the fact that like classic really isn't all that old anymore, or just we are? Which way you want to go first?
Well, I mean, when it comes to classics, you got to go all the way back to the beginning. Tactics, which was what, 54, 55. So that's like 70 years now. Yeah. That's longer than a lot of people have been alive. And there are some people that were young when that came out and remember when that game first came out that are still playing war games. And that's great. I would think kind of almost opposite, in a way that like the old school people would think that, well, it's kind of there's like a dichotomy there. It's like you've got the old school people say this stuff was great. The old games were great. This new stuff is garbage. And then you have the newer players that are going to go, wow, this new stuff is fantastic. Oh, how could you guys play with only three colors on a map? And how could you play with these crappy counters and stuff? But then everyone reaches a point where they just ignore that. They get over that. And I think on both sides, where you go, hey, you know, these newer games, all these new colors and new way of presenting the information is really good. And then some of the newer guys will look at the old games and go, now that I understand and appreciate war games more, I can appreciate them even more where they came from by playing these older games. And it kind of goes away. Now, for some people, they're going to dig their feet in and, you know, say, nah, the whole new stuff's crap. Some of the newer guys are going to say, all the old stuff's crap. But all you're doing is shortchanging yourself by not experiencing all of those games. Because some of the old games, they didn't stand up as well in, you know, the test of time. But they're still classics for a reason. They're what laid the groundwork for the games of today.
Mo nailed it there. So as you were asking the question, I was thinking, so I'm kind of a strange bird where, you know, I got back in, I don't know, late 70s, early 80s, I remember getting a couple of war games and just they were over my head and I didn't have anyone to play them with. And I gravitated to video games and only got back into war games like maybe, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago now. And I look back and I see some of these, like I used to go to the board game store and see the war games on the shelves and like, you know, but that's where my nostalgia ends. But seeing both sides, just like Mo said, dismiss the other is just, I don't know. It's just to me silly. Like there's, you know, and I've seen the other extreme where, you know, I've seen guys say all old games have done it all. There's no new ideas. And, you know, flip side of that is like war games are so much, or board games in general, really, that turns into a bigger issue. Like board games are so much more advanced now than even, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And I think there's good ideas and fun to be found in both eras. If you want to divide it into two eras, like, I think you'll find great stuff in both. I think the graphically, you know, I've been a graphic designer for years. I transitioned to UX design. I can appreciate what they were doing with limited print, no computers. And it's kind of made a resurgence where you see this retro style, people trying to copy it. So I appreciate what the old look has. So even in that respect, it's like, I love seeing what graphics people can do now. Some of these great illustrators, some of the stuff GMT is putting out, like just unbelievable. But you know, by the same token, seeing some pretty cool iconic covers, like was it Panzer Leader? Like, I mean, that's it just transcends the wargaming world, where it's like that could just be somewhere. It's just like such a beautiful cover. And the same can be said about the map and the pieces. So I think Mo hit the nail on the head. So I'm just echoing what he said there.
I think it's funny you started off saying that you're a strange bird. I was like, well, your name is Molotov Cockatiel. So yeah,
that's right.
You're basically a flaming bird at that point, or an on fire bird, or whatever you want to say, a phoenix essentially. Right. But yeah, it's true. And you can use movies as a comparison, because people will look at the newer movies and say, wow, these are great because you have all these new technologies and movies and newer actors that you're familiar with. And then you look at some of the Turner classic movies, you know, they're on it, or Turner movie classics or whatever it is. And then you start appreciating the performances and the cinematography back then. I still think one of the greatest special effects movies ever done that stands the test of time, especially when you look at how the special effects were back in the time, was the original King Kong from 1933.
Yeah. Stop motion, right?
Yeah. That's just hard work. Harryhausen, when he did all his stuff with Sinbad and all that stuff. Yeah. That was all just he's doing it stop motion. That was all hard work and it still stands up. Yeah. You can find the flaws in it, but compared to today's CGI, but then you look at some of the CGI today and you're like, wow, that's really garbage. And then some of it's fantastic, you know.
Yeah, just for
the problem I have with some of the CGI is that because a lot of the technology is reused between video gaming and movie making, that I kind of feel like I'm watching a video game instead of a movie, and I want those experiences to be different.
And, yeah, it can take you out of it. Yeah,
yeah, and like, other people are fine having that experience be the same. And like, I get it. I'm the old dude. I'm going to lose this argument. Okay, whatever. But I still like what I like and don't like what I don't like. And I don't want my movies to look like video games.
So. Well, the other thing too, is you end up in the end, it really comes down to whether it's an older movie, newer movie, older war game, newer war game, it comes down to what the content is. Even if the presentation's lacking because of limitations of the time, it comes down to how fun and how good is the war game. Today you have 40, 50 page rule books. Back then you had 4, 6, 8 page rule books. And they were easy to get into. Oh, of course, they had complicated games too, but sometimes you just go, wow, it's really nice to sit down and play a simpler war game that you can, you know, reread the rules really quick and, you know, remember how to play it, and then sit down and just jam through it in a few hours.
So looking back at some of those classic war games, and again, like we're not going to get into some definitional jihad of where the classic line sort of cuts off. Like everybody's got their own definition of what they consider to be the classics. But I think going back to some of the old Avalon Hill ones before, like even predating SPI's existence as a company, when Avalon Hill was spitting out one, maybe two war games at most per year, some of those classics that people still want to come back to and hit the table regularly are games like Africa Corps, the original Battle of the Bulge game, the original Gettysburg and Waterloo games, and even rolling slightly forward some to John Prato's Third Reich and the Panzerleader Panzer Blitz series. These things are still around. They still hit the table quite regularly. Our local game group here that we've got the Armchair Dragoons game day that, you know, War Game Day that meets first Sunday of every month at our local game store here at Gamers Armory. And we've got a dude who, he's an older guy, really nice dude, has been bringing out some of his old Avalon Hill classics because he's saying, man, I haven't played these things in, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. And he's pulling out the old Avalon Hill Stalingrad and War at Sea. And he's getting folks sit down and play. And they're like, holy cow, this is great, because they're getting an entire game done in the 4 hour block that we've got space on the tables there for. Yeah. And so what do you think it is that sort of stands that test of time, Mo? Like, what is it about these games that keeps people coming back and consistently having a good time with them?
Oh, they're classic. They're familiar. And
it's not the graphics.
You know, not the graphics. I mean, but you have games that are old that have that do get updated. Perfect example. Russian Campaign just had a couple different versions of it reprinted, you know, by GMT and by Compass. So you have newer versions of the graphics for a classic old game. And the one that was done by Consim, I think it was, that did the Russian Campaign 5th edition, had everything. Every possible rule that was ever done for that game is added into it, whereas the other one was just the classic. The one that by Compass was just the classic game. It comes down to familiarity and just solid concepts. Yeah. Are there flaws that some people would maybe want to see done differently? Sure. Now that we have more experience with war games and there's been more ideas and more evolution in the game, in the hobby, sure. But when it comes back to it, it's just that it's that comfortable chair that you like to sit in because it just feels good and you're happy and content. That's what those games bring to people, and that's why they keep getting played, and they're easy to teach too, so you can introduce them to a lot of newer war gamers. Yeah,
I think also Bill, like he touched. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was saying chime in here, but you already
were. Yeah, I was chiming. So I think there is definitely obviously a nostalgia factor, but I think Mo touched on it that they're actually good, and it should come as no surprise. Like, you know, to use the movie analogy, you go back, and it's not just like I maybe compare it more to music than movies, where it's not just good for its time; it's just good. Like these are good ideas, and then going back and you know, I'm working on my own game, and I going back to research some of the what's been done before. And it's like, how did they do this? Like so much work was put in, and what the final product was good. It's not like it's like all this cute little thing that was good for its time. Like this was freaking good for when it came out. And even for now, like, and that's why, you know, the good ones that like the history is strong, like the gameplay is fun. It's, you know, revolutionary for its time, but it still holds up now. It's still fun to play. And you get these new war gamers like me, even though, like, I think I'm probably the same age as you guys, but I consider myself a new war gamer. Like, I still love watching these playthroughs, like learning the rules of these games, because they're genuinely, they are good rules, good game design. And that's what, like Mo said, that's what matters. It's that good game design, and that, you know, good and bad, like it might evolve, but it's, you still know what's good. Just like when you listen to a Sweet Leaf from back in the day from Black Sabbath, you know, that's, they still play it in hockey stadiums now because it's still good.
I'm going to throw a thought out here and let you guys either agree or disagree as you need, but just an idea. And this is something that occurred to me earlier today when I was thinking about kind of some prep for tonight. And that is,
you prepare for these shows?
Well, not normally a whole lot, but in the case of tonight, I there were a couple of things I did kind of want to make sure we hit. Mm-hmm. So probably a little more than anything. I didn't go so far as to like write anything down.
You know? So you weren't all totally professional and stuff.
Oh God, no. If I wanted that, I'd invite Brian Boyer back on the show. Like, that dude shows up with a list of questions to ask people. I'm like, come on, man, nice. What are you doing? So it's you mentioned the simplicity factor earlier, Mo. That you know, we're talking 4, 6, 8 pages of rules, and maybe it's like 6 pages of rules in the 8-page book, and the last 2 pages the actual like scenarios with the different setups or whatever. I wonder if one of the issues with these things in terms of playability, or maybe it's sort of the ease with which people can grasp what's going on, is the fact that the history isn't perfect in a lot of cases. And it's not that it was intentionally abstracted necessarily for playability's sake, because while the guys doing the game design back then were really darn smart, I'm not sure that the hobby had advanced to the point where there was this whole playability versus realism argument going on. I also think that historical research has changed a lot in the last 50 or 60 years, that we now know more about some of the battles and events and campaigns that we were studying, that we were designing games around, than we do today. Particularly with the opening of, you know, in World War II, like the opening of the old Soviet archives, that we're now able to get access to things that we never had access to before. But the idea that the game designs weren't trying to be perfect representations of reality. They were trying to give you a good sense of what was going on in those battlefields. These were the units available. Here's our terrain. Let's just go hash it out. And not that it was glorified chess, because it was a little more than that, but they weren't overly worried about some sort of perfect representation of reality, or trying to necessarily have a high fidelity to reality. And so what would you think of, you know, how does that hit you, Mo?
Well, it's true. I mean, the one thing that I'll say really did revolutionize a lot of things, including wargaming, is the internet. Because with the internet, you have the world's greatest research tool at your fingertips. Everyone does. So before, you'd have to either get something from the Library of Congress, or you'd have to go digging through old bookstores, or reach out through contacts and get books that you could use for research. And a lot of times you didn't have to. So you made stuff up based on, to the best of your knowledge and your best guess, to try to fill in the blanks on research. And at the same time, these guys were that was the nascent days of war game design. They were creating war games as they went. They were creating the science of war game design. Now we've got 40, 50, 60, 70 years of design behind us that we know about, that we can go and read books that have been written by these guys, like Dunnigan's book, stuff like that, Perla's book, talk about design, and we can learn from that. Newer designers can learn from that, and experienced designers can, along with all this information that's already readily available to us now. And you've got a greater set of tools in front of you to build a more complex and more involved game that's hopefully better than what was done back in the day. But in the end, we're still using that same framework from those original war games.
Bill, what do you think?
So I was going to challenge that a little bit, because a couple of games that came to mind with, that just got reprinted was Pacific War and the Vietnam, the GMT one. And both of those are pretty huge, and they came out, you know, I guess back then. So I mean, I think they had their fair share of like complex getting deep and like trying to model everything. And I mean, this touches on a subject that I love, because it's with wargaming is such a unique thing in that it's you have to bring together someone that knows or cares enough about history to get that part right, and what's in mainstream board gaming, to create something that's balanced, fun, interesting, looks good, all that stuff, aesthetically pleasing. So I cases of like other kind of people in the same boat as me, kind of want to be war game designers, where, you know, they do want to model everything, and you're reading the history and you're like, how important is that to the battle? And like, does that make the game then too fiddly? But said, I mean, that's the great thing about the internet, is you can see, not only look up historic facts, everywhere, you can find all like different viewpoints that you couldn't find before, except for what you took out of the library. But now you can also see like who made what game before. Like, you know, so my game, I swear I'm not doing a plug here, but my game is on Alexander the Great. And I'm looking up, I still have not played it because I don't want to be overly influenced by it. But Alexander the Great by Berg and the great Mark Herman. And, you know, looking at the decisions they made, looking at the bibliography, and just seeing like how they made those decisions and how they turned that into a game where it's like, you know, now we can, it's easy for us to just look it up and see what they did before, but those guys back then, you know, I wonder, like, were they more historians or were they more game designers? Like, how did those two things come together, and how did they even meet each other in this age of no internet? It just blows my mind, and how they produce like such a quality product.
Well, the other thing too, when it comes to design process, is when you look at back, and I was actually, my comment about the early designs were really more from the 50s through to the 70s and into the 80s. After that, I think it started getting, in the 90s, it started getting a little more cohesive as far as how things were worked, as far as development and things like that. And as we're in today's day and age with the internet, and then you have not only designers, but you get teams. You've got the designer, you got developers, you've got a whole support system around them that looks over the files and spell checks it and grammar checks it and everything else. Whereas before, some of these games were designed in 30 days back in the day. So, you know, it's like they were cranking them out. So the science of, or the process, I should say, not science, but the process of war game design has gotten more advanced, and it's a lot more, there's more of a team effort than before. It was more of a solo effort, or maybe two guys, you know, maybe three.
I'm going to challenge that notion with you, Mo, but I'm going to let you go ahead and finish the point you're on.
No, that was it.
Well, so the idea of it being more of a team effort these days, I'm not necessarily as convinced on, for this reason. I think we are more aware of who the people in the process are because of the way the credits are put into the games, where you don't just have the designer, but you have the developer, you have the playtesters, you have all those folks getting the credit in the game rules these days. Whereas if you go get out an older, you know, a 60s era Avalon Hill game or the early 70s era SPI games, you might have the designer credited. You'll have the graphics guy credited. You're not going to see the playtesters in there, and you're probably not going to see anybody from the development side of things there. But I think one of the other things that's so different about it from then versus now is how much of the design work was done in-house versus now it's all freelancers. Back then you had, I mean, SPI set up in New York had 15, 20 folks on staff, any of whom could be designing a game, developing another one, and then like helping stuff boxes every other Thursday for mailing. You talk to some of the folks that had worked there back then, Mark Herman among them, but you know, some of those other folks, the things that they did during the actual work day as they were going through, they would have two or three designs in progress along with helping with other designs. And a lot of that work, I think, got done. I don't think it was as formally stratified as it is now, but I think because the credit, the way we credit the people has changed, we're more aware of who that team is now than we were before. I think that's one of the big differences.
Yeah.
When did the job title game developer come about? Like, I imagine, you know, not until recently, right?
It's been, this sounds crazy. Keep in mind that recently, how far back is recently? Because 20 years ago was still the 2000s. And so I would suspect you'll probably start finding some credits late 90s, early 2000s for game developers. But without actually grabbing some old game books and digging through them, I'm not sure where I would start to see the first appearance. I'm just kind of spitballing that it's probably right around the turn of the millennium. As to when you would start seeing that. Mo, if you've got any sort of definitive proof before that, I'm all ears.
No,
audience, same thing. Like, if you guys want to chime in the comments and let us know.
I think when it comes to development, like you're talking like SPI, where you had that factory warehouse type environment, you know, you'd be working on a design and maybe for lunch you'd say, hey, let's check this out, or let's try a little bit of combat in this game because I've got to work out a problem. And two or three people sit there while they're eating their sandwiches and they play through a couple combats and figure it out. Right there, that would be your development, but that would not be your official development team. It would be informal, but it would be with your fellow designer slash warehouse workers that would be doing it.
I just went across the room and grabbed a pair of the old flat packs. So as we are recording and you guys go on talking about whatever you're going to talk about next, I am cracking open MechWar 77 and the Modern Battles Quad to see if there's any developers listed in any of these. So
yeah, and listening to the panel discussions, like both on YouTube and at, you know, expos, it sounded like exactly that. And like other game designers that happen to be working in the office at the same time, like that's what it sounds like, kind of a freewheeling, not a dedicated person, but it's interesting,
yeah,
because
now it's more of a process. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so, and when you look at, like, you know, the complainy reviews where someone's like, this game needed a developer, it's just so interesting because that you never hear or see that in these older games.
Yeah, so just cracked open MechWar 77. So this is copyright 1975 with SPI. And the design credits on the back of the rule book, game design was done again. Physical systems design and graphics was Simonson. Game development, there's a developer listed here, wow. And that's Irad B. Hardy. Play testing, it lists Harris and Kostikian. And for production, I'm not sure who Milken was or Catalano, but we know who Kevin Zucker is. I'm not sure who Linda Mosco was, but Zucker's listed for production on this one. So this is 75 and there's a game development credit in here. Wow. So it's way earlier than I thought it was.
Yeah.
Well, there's also
I would guess late 90s.
There's also a more formalized process now because board games in general, not just war games, but board games in general have become more formalized as far as like development and playtesting compared to the way they were 50 years ago, because now there's more of a process that everything will go through, checking the math and balancing, especially for the hobby side of things. They want to make sure it's as balanced as possible, so that way you don't have a runaway leader. And if there is, because the way the game works that way, there's always a catch-up mechanic or something like that. War games, you know, you had mentioned that before, Bill, about the balance in a game. And that's another topic that could be its own podcast, is balance in war games. Do we need it or not? I don't think you necessarily need to have balance in a war game, meaning you each have the equal, you know, amount of forces and stuff like that. If you're portraying a historic battle, if it was even, yeah, sure, then do it that way. If not, there are other ways to make it balanced out by just having certain objectives for the player that does not have the advantage. You know, you can give them objectives where, yeah, you know what, you're probably going to still lose this battle, but you can technically win on points if you deny certain objectives for a certain amount of turns or whatever. So even though you lose the battle overall, which historically happened, and it's going to happen to you too because you're outnumbered 3-1, you can still kind of win a minor victory or something.
You win the game if you're not winning, even though you're not winning the battle.
Exactly. So that way, that is how you can balance. That's one way you can balance it out.
Yeah, the math is not in the Texans' favor at the Alamo. It doesn't matter how balanced you try to be.
No, you're going to lose. Right. And at the end, you better tell them you're a screamer.
You lose.
Yeah. One of my favorite lines was Billy Bob Thornton. And when he was going to get killed, he's like, I got to warn you, I'm a screamer.
Yeah, well, if nothing else, tonight's podcast has been educational for me in pulling open those old SPI games and finding developer credits there, as opposed to it just being an assumed process in-house. Mm-hmm. I was, while you were talking just there, I also looked at the credits on the original Modern Battles quad, because I've got both the first and second mod quads. Four different designers, Isby, Dunnigan, Hardy, and there was somebody else. I don't remember who the fourth one was because I've already put them back away. But about a half a dozen developers shared across all four games. So that's, you know, it was a very real process back then and still there. So I don't want to say I'm at a loss. I think it's kind of cool that.
See, you should have brought Mark Herman in for this, because he would have given us all a lot more detail.
Exactly. He'll give us the lowdown. Like, was it, you know, was the game developer just like the accountant, the guy that does the books, or is it like someone legit that, you know, it does game development and like can tell
or is
you,
it,
like,
you know what, it's your turn to be developer on my game, and then on your game, I'll be developer.
That's what it sounded like. And right. Yeah.
That actually happened in the mod quad pack, though, because like David Isby is credited as a developer on Hardy's game and vice versa. Like Hardy's credited on Isby's game. So that did happen. look, we could probably call Mark. I've also got Brad Hessel here in town with me who worked with those guys back at SPI way back when. So I happen to know Brad. I know him through other circles, but he was part of that whole SPI crew.
A little earlier, I would message Mark and say, hey, why don't you come on real quick?
Yeah.
But it's a little bit late.
Tell us the process. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that that's ever happened where we messaged somebody mid podcast that wasn't scheduled to be there. We've had a few people show up late because like they forgot the start time or they, you know, had something else going on, but I don't know that we've ever just sort of, you know, flagged somebody down to wave them into the podcast in the middle of it all.
That'd well, one thing's for certain. And if Mark is listening to this, he's going to probably chuckle out loud and say he's right. If we brought Mark in right now, this is not going to be an hour long podcast. I can tell
you.
It's going to be an hour and 40 minutes easy because he'll tell us stories that'll go for at least an hour.
And we won't want him to stop either. That's the thing.
No. Like, yeah.
The 12th season of Mentioned in Dispatches is made possible by all of our Patreon supporters who pledged at the top level. The Armchair Dragoons would like to thank Michael Sunborg, Fred and his dog, Chet Bell, Hellcat Six, Patrick Geraghty, Stagger Wing, Kevin Bertram, Mike Quigley, Martok, and Joseph Knoll for their support of the Regiment of Strategy Gaming, which helps us bring you the best strategy gaming articles, events, and this podcast. You can join us as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
I'm curious, you two, so you guys have insight into these like game publishers now, and in your experience, do their processes, are they similar? I mean, obviously they probably vary with like the size of the company, but like, you know, two relatively the same company, are they completely different or do they sort of mirror each other in how they run things? And, you know,
I think for War Game publishers,
you're talking about two similar publishers today, not like comparing somebody today to somebody from the 70s, right?
No, similar today. So like,
okay.
I got no idea
what they were doing in the 70s, man. I was nine. You know what I mean?
Come on. You weren't doing inside journalism back then?
Yeah.
Well, I think today it would definitely be different because like we were saying, you had that office warehouse type environment back then when that was your day job was designing and developing games or testing them or whatever, and then packing boxes. Today, War Games, the publishers, a lot of people don't really even appreciate how small most of these publishers are, nearly all of them. You're talking 2, 4, 5 people on average for most of these war game companies. So the stuff is much smaller now compared to back in the day. And just like Brent said before, you don't have designers on staff per se. You've got just contractors essentially that are, hey, I have a design. Do you want to print it? And yeah, okay, we come to an agreement. And then the designer goes off and works with their group of people and creates a game. And okay, I think it's good. We're done. They hand it in and then it goes into the development process there for production, whether it's further refinement and development or not, or if it's just working on graphics and playtesting some more with a blind playtest group, and then just, you know, polishing it up for print. But you're talking very small houses here for these war game publishers. That's why not all of them put out a lot of games per year. Legion, for example, put out just a handful because it's just a couple of people.
Yeah. I think so your full-time staff that you've got at the war game companies today are not your designers, as Mo mentioned. They're your admin staff. They're your business team. And really, Mo, I think you and I might've had this conversation with Gary once upon a time that there's probably at most 20 to 25 people who are paying their bills with a full-time job in the wargaming business in any sort of role or capacity. I don't know that it's more than about 25 or so.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a few dozen at most. I mean, there are people that are, it's a supplementary income if they're retired and they're just designing for fun and it's just mad money.
Yeah. That's not your primary income,
but exactly.
And the folks that we're talking about mainly are folks like the warehouse staff out in Hanford at GLT.
Sure.
Yeah. It's not the designers by and large. There's a few of those guys where that's their main income, but not a lot of those folks. I think you do see some habitual relationships between designers and certain publishers. For instance, Mark Simonich, like most of his stuff is going to GMT because it's the 40X series that those guys publish. Mo, you would know better than me. Gregory M. Smith. I think most of his stuff's going to Compass, right? He's not doing a lot with other folks.
No, he's done some with GMT with the Constant Press stuff with like the Hunters and all the, that series, but primarily he's doing it through Compass.
Yeah. Well, and the exact opposite end of that spectrum is Herman, who he doesn't even know how many publishers he's got publishing his games at this point. We're talking Herman Luttman, right? I mean, we even put a poll up last season when we had him on the podcast about how many publishers are publishing games from Herman Luttman. Herman doesn't know. If you ask him, he won't know.
Yeah, he's got Revolution. He's got Flying Pig. He's got Tiny Battles, which is also under Flying Pig. He's got GMT. Yeah. I mean, he's all over the place.
He'd have to
he gets around. Let me tell you, like, that guy.
Start counting on his fingers to try and come up with a total. I think one of the other things that you see is that the bigger companies like a GMT or a Compass will probably have some habitual relationships with certain developers also. Mm-hmm. That will be involved with the development of a variety of games. In some cases, probably working on a series if the games in question are within a particular series, something like Commands and Colors or Levy and Campaign or the Combat Commander series, something like that for GMT.
Yeah, Mitch's Next War series.
Yeah, the Next War series. Another good example. David Heath's got a handful of folks that are habitual developers on the Lock and Load Tactical series or the World War E5 series. Yeah. But I think for some of the smaller publishers, they're going to have a little bit more of kind of a one-to-one relationship with, hey, I happen to like this person who's a good developer and I know they know how to do certain things. So I'm going to get that one person working on this particular series. Doug Miller did a whole lot of the development work for Sean Chick's Horse and Musket series for Hollenspiel. But Doug's done a bunch of development work for Horse and Musket. I don't think he's on the series anymore. He was for the first three or four volumes, but he hasn't done a ton of other development for Hollenspiel on other games, but he also hasn't done that same era for other publishers. That was just sort of a one-off because he happened to have that relationship with Hollenspiel. He's done a couple of other games, but not a bunch. Whereas I think for some of the smaller publishers, they may rely a little more on the designer to bring a developer to the table.
Or, say, you have a guy like Kim Kanger, for example, with Legion, who's designer, artist, and developer. Or David Thompson, he's basically buoyed DVG with the Valiant Defense series. He brings that game completely done. And he just hands him the file. Say, here, go print.
Yeah. Well, David's a little bit of a rare bird in that he collaborates with a lot of people. The Valiant Defense series is the anomaly in the things David does, working with Liz, working with Trevor Benjamin, working with other people, working with Nils, working with whoever else it is for the design work that he does. But like Herman, regardless of who his publisher is, Fred Manzo's usually involved in a lot of the development. Same thing, Ryan Heilman's usually involved in a bunch of the development. So it's... regardless of who the publisher is. So
It's easier for, if you have, like, for example, Herm and Fred's relationship. If Fred has a design, then Herm's gonna help develop it, and when Herm has a design, Fred develops it. So it's great to have that partner in the fact that, you're not only friends, but you can really back each other up and help each other by, hey, I've got this game and I'm about 90-95% of the way, and that developer takes it the other 5 or 10%. And that 5 or 10% is massively critical to a game working or not. And that's why it's always good to have somebody that can balance out what your skills and abilities are with that development expertise, like Fred and Herm do in that relationship.
Yeah. And at this point, we are way off the topic of classic wargaming.
Wait, there was a topic?
Well, we started with one, but as with every one of our podcasts, God knows where we're going.
We went down tangent way.
Yeah, it's sort of like Gary's counterclipping show, right?
Yes.
There's a nominal topic, and you might genuflect in that direction once in a while, but it's sort of an optional thing.
It grows organically.
Mo, just thinking of your own personal wargame library, what do you have in your library that you think would definitely fall squarely in that classic wargame category of somebody looking at your library going, oh my God, you've got all these great classic games. Which ones are they pointing to on your shelf for what those classics are?
I gotta look here.
You gotta turn around.
Commander Command, Tactics 2. Of course, you always gotta throw in Tactics 2. I always gotta give props to that game.
Bill, this is coming your way too. So if you gotta like pivot and look at the bookshelf, you know.
Yeah, I'm having to lean around, you know, turn around and stuff. Because I've got stuff everywhere. I've got stuff in over on my right side, my left side. I got stuff in the closet. I got stuff behind me. I got stuff all over the place. The Fleet series, that's another classic, old one from the 80s. What else we got? Victory in the Pacific. A lot of these old school classic games, I would say that would definitely fit in the classic genre.
Yeah, I've got War and Peace up on the shelf there. The SPI City fight, I think most folks would probably be willing to count that as a classic. A bunch of the SPI stuff that I have is the slightly more off the wall stuff. It's things like MechWar 77 or the Mod Quads, just because that's the genre of war game that I'm more interested in. So that is a little different. I've got the old Avalon Hill Third Reich. I've got a Squad Leader up there on the shelf. I did get rid of my copies of Panzer Leader. I had two copies of Panzer Leader and sold those to a friend a couple of years ago because I just wasn't ever getting them to the table, and I knew that he would. So those have shuffled their way out of my library. But
that's very true, especially for a lot of those games. You end up you play them, and then you're like, "Yeah, this isn't you know, getting played." And I had to do a big call a couple of years ago because I moved. So I was like, I got rid of a lot of games at that point, and I've been kind of pruning games down still, trying to keep them down, because otherwise, I mean, you can easily get 500, 600, 700 games, and you're like, I don't have the space for them, and I'm not playing them, so what's the point?
Yeah. I do have an SPI Firefight. There's a lamp in the way is why I didn't see that one up there on the shelf. So
City Fight is one I've always wanted to get, never had, but the reason I never got it is because it requires multiple people to play, and yes, it's not something you could play solitaire, you know? So I'm still kind of tempted to get one just because I want to have it and I want to mess with it and just see, okay, I know you technically can't play it solitaire, but I still want to try to find a way.
Yeah. Bill, what about you? What might be on your shelf?
Well, you guys are going to be disappointed. Not many. So mine are all reprints because, like I said, I've only been in the hobby, I'd say, really for 10 years. So a Pacific War Russian campaign. I don't know if you want to count MBT. That's and I think there's a few decision ones that I'm not sure. Like Battle for Germany, I think that's a reprint, but I'm not sure. Not many. Most of my games are more recent, I'd say, came out within the last 20 years.
Yeah, I should have. I looked over at that shelf too. I should have said MBT while I was at it. But
I didn't dig out like the magazine or folio games. That probably would have added a few more.
Oh yeah,
there. I've unloaded a variety of classics over the years. Once upon a time, I had a handful of American Civil War games. I just don't enjoy war games that take place in the American Civil War. So the old Chancellorsville that I had, the original like 64 printing or whatever it was, that one left my library 25, 30 years ago because I wasn't going to play it. And I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that I have happily done a bunch lately is pick up some of the updated versions of some of those old ones, especially the GDW Third World War as reprinted by Compass.
Oh yeah.
And Bruce's NATO as republished by Compass.
Yeah.
Was very happy to pick those up in newer formats. So there are some that I've not really reacquired, but I was happy to get the new versions of.
Yeah, I got third.
I do have those as well.
Yeah, those two. And then of course the Russian campaign. I actually have both versions of that. The Compass and the GMT version too. So
is it worth buying both?
I think it's worth having both because it's a classic system, and this way you can play the classic system or you can play the classic system and then add all the optional stuff that you want to add in. So you get the whole smash in the one and you get just the standard classic in the other. So it's worth getting both, I think.
For the audience that may be curious, keep in mind that when you've got a game that's been around that long, you have a lot of errata that's been cleaned up over the years, mm-hmm. as well as a lot of variant rules or modifications that have come out in all sorts of different magazines and online discussions and whatever over the past, I don't know, 60, 65 years at this point since the first one came, since it was originally released. So there's a lot of material over the years to incorporate.
50 years now, because it was 74 it came out.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that's old.
It's up there with me.
But it's a classic. It's still around for a reason. games that are around. When you think about it, people say, well, why is it around? You know, why is it getting redone again? It's like, it's been around a half century for a reason. It's a good game. And it's also popular for tournament players, people who want to play that tournament style. It's a great game for that. Then you can just sit there and study those opening moves and what you can do and what you have to watch out for. Same for like Bitter Woods and things like that. The tournament players love that. Me personally, I despise tournament style play. That's just me. Because then it just feels too rehearsed. I just rather have complete chaos. I think it's more fun.
The problem I have with the tournament is I just don't want to play one game over and over and over. I'd much rather play a bunch of different things.
I respect those guys though, because that's so different than the bulk of the hobby where everyone's just looking for the next thing and things get forgotten. So it's almost like chess players who they actually sit there and they're like, oh, I wonder if, you know, how can I play better? How can I do this better? So that is kind of cool. Like, I don't know if I have the attention to do that. Like, but respect to those guys that do.
No, that's spot on right there, what you said. And that's exactly why me personally, I'm not knocking tournament play or anything. It's just, that's why I don't like it, is because it is just like chess. And I have been, two people tried teaching me chess and I just bounced off me like water on a rock. I was like, yeah, no, that's okay. It's just, it didn't sit with me. Well, I'm not knocking the game. It's just not for me, but yeah, that's what tournament play seems like. But I credit those people for sitting down, studying those games like that, and then keeping notes and looking at all these opening moves and these counters and all that stuff. I think that's fantastic.
It's so cool. So, yeah.
Let me get to a slightly different question here. Still staying on that, you know, on that classic war game discussion. Has there been a classic that you've had, you know, something that's widely considered a classic that you've had a chance to play recently within the last 5, 8, 10 years or so, that you played it and you just went, you know, this just doesn't feel like it holds up to me? Bill, is there something that, you know, as you've come back to wargaming where somebody, oh man, you got to play this. This was all-time classic. And you played it and you just went, just don't see it, man.
Honestly, no. I mean, for me, it's either, you know, I appreciate, because it's in a way, it's all new to me. So I'm a noob, like, so I've yet to be jaded in any way by the hobby. So for the most part, I've enjoyed everything. I watch a lot of playthroughs, a lot of like playthroughs of classics, and you know, it all resonates with me. So I can't say like I'm not tired of it. Like, and even though I say like I've only been wargaming for 10 years, like I was pretty into board games in general back in the 80s, 70s and 80s. But so, you know, I played clunkers back then in, you know, mainstream games that were like, boy, this is just garbage. But I've yet to encounter that in war games. I've luckily been able to find something redeeming in everything. I've either watched playthroughs or played, actually sat down and played. And there was a few at Compass that, you know, we actually learned the rule. Russian campaign was one. That's what sold me on it at Compass Expo. Someone, you know, showed us the rules and, you know, there's only a few pages of rules and it was like, holy shit, this is great. I hope you can swear on this podcast.
Oh yeah. no problem.
So yeah, I've been lucky so far. No.
Mo, what about you? Has there been one that folks said, man, you got to do it, and it
Monopoly.
Bounced off you?
Monopoly. Monopoly becomes monotonous. No, I can't think of any off the top of my head, because I've gotten pretty good at even with the classics. I'll just look at a game and I get a vibe off of it. And most of the time, with the older games, especially, I'd be like, yeah, no, that's not going to work for me for whatever reason. I'm not going to waste my time playing it, 'cause it's not a topic of interest to me or something. Some of the newer games have, you know, I've gotten, I think, more, negative experiences with the newer games than the older games. I think 'cause the older games seem so, similar, that maybe that was part of the reason why it was easy to go from game to game. Whereas some of the newer games, you're like expecting something new and cool, and then you play it and you're like, yeah, I was expecting more from that one, you know, or something. And then you get turned off. But I haven't played any classics that have turned me off in the past 5, 10 years that I can think of.
Yeah, I can think of two in particular that, just going back to them, just don't do it for me at this point anymore. And one of them never really did too much, but going back to Africa Corps, the old Avalon Hill Africa Corps, it seems like no matter how much you completely redo the whole up and down, back and forth nature of that North African warfare, it still comes down to a dog pile of units and a single die roll on the second to last turn on the turn track at Tobruk. Yeah. Right? I mean, it's like just it all of the lead up back and forth, no matter what, you've still got, you know, it's all just setting up that big final fight at Tobruk, because that's where everybody sort of runs out of breath kind at of the same time.
It's kind of why I don't play a lot of North Africa games. It all feels like it's going to be the same. It's going to be just that to me.
Well, but I think there are some North Africa games where you can end up having sort of that final denouement, like to throw in the vocabulary words here, elsewhere other than Tobruk. Alternatively, you can zoom in on Tobruk and do things a little differently as you zoom in on it, and that's not too bad either.
Yeah.
You know, that works out as well. The other one that just didn't really do it for me was the old Avalon Hill Luftwaffe. And like, I'm not a big aerial game dude anyway, because I'm more of a ground combat, like you, Mo, right? We drove tanks around, blew shit up. So I'm happiest when there's a tank in the game. But I was more than willing to give Luftwaffe a fair shake, and I couldn't do it. It just didn't really do it for me. And part of it is aerial warfare is not really my thing, but I enjoyed the Wing Leader games, and those are aerial warfare. And the one that Keith is working on right now for Lock and Load, that's the squadron level air game in the World at War 85 series. He showed me an early playtest version of that at the Fall Assembly out here. Mm-hmm. And I had a blast with that one. We had a lot of fun with that one.
Yeah, that is a fun one. I think I was actually the first playtester of that. The first person, not playtester, but the first blind playtester of that game. At a local con here, and I thought it was awesome. I thought it was,
yeah, so
I was,
you know, like, wow, with definitely the, going with on. The hexes with kind of the spiral down to
yeah, you change your elevation.
The elevation, yeah. So you know exactly what I'm talking about. That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed the hell out of that. Luftwaffe, not happening. Just
why didn't you enjoy it? What was it about Luftwaffe that just didn't do it for you? Because I was going to ask you actually if you liked Wing Leader, because I was wondering if it was like one of those where the emphasis is on the vehicle itself. And then you actually said you like Wing Leader. So what was it about the other one, Luftwaffe, you didn't like?
I think Wing Leader to me feels like there's a little more room for maneuver, whereas Luftwaffe felt a little more attritional. Just I got a pile of counters, you got a pile of counters, they meet in the middle and they both sort of dissolve a little. And
so it was a ground war game in the air is really what it comes down to. That was the style.
It's sort of how it felt. Yeah. And I didn't mind. In fact, like, I was looking forward to some of the targeting aspects of Luftwaffe, because that's kind of the whole point, right? The Allied bombing campaign, like you're intentionally trying to target the German war production machine, that you would do a bunch of this targeting planning. And then the first time you ran into a wall of German aircraft, you know, out there intercepting, it just sort of turned into, you know, any one of the battle scenes from Braveheart. And it just didn't really feel like there was a whole lot of management you could do other than, you know, I guess the best analogy is it felt like one of those old electric football games. Right?
Oh, okay.
Everything's just
jittering around.
Yeah. It just didn't really feel like I had a whole lot of degrees of freedom for trying to find some way to maneuver through the problem, that it was just a pure math problem. As long as I had more dudes in the pile than you did, even if I rolled average to you, I was going to come out ahead because I had more guys. Otherwise, if you started with the smaller pile of dudes in the fight, you needed some Herculean rolls to get by, and good luck with that. It really kind of fell flat, where something like Wing Leader, with the maneuver that you had in that, particularly because Wing Leader does a good job of representing elevation. Even though it's a squadron level game, that those elevation changes really mattered. And that's not something you get a lot of in Luftwaffe. The elevation sort of irrelevant, which seems weird.
It was a product of its time. It was basically you said, stacks and stacks.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just not one that I enjoy. Now, this doesn't mean other people can't enjoy it. Y'all enjoy it. Have fun, man. Go to town. It didn't do it for me.
So Africa Corps, I had a question on that one as well. So when you get to that, you know, finale at Tobruk, like, I guess I'm wondering, does it take into account everything that happened before, or does what happened before feel irrelevant? Because like a good game design, I feel like it could be exciting, you know, to come down to that last battle, as long as, you know, I did pretty well in the last 10 hours we've been playing, and you can't just throw that out the window and all of a sudden it's just, you know, that's all meaningless.
Not that it's irrelevant, because it does sort of determine what you show up for the last fight with, like what's left to get to that fight. And quite frankly, a lot of the enjoyment for Africa Corps comes before the end of the game, right? It comes from a lot of the back and forth and the wild swings of, you know, chasing a dude through the desert, and then he finally gets a chance to resupply because you chased him close enough to a supply dumps, and he turns around and chases you all the way back to yours. And so there's a lot of that back and forth, which is relatively representative of what happened in North Africa. A lot of that can be enjoyable. I don't know that I would enjoy playing it to the depth of detail of something like DAC 2. But to me, the Africa Corps games, the fun was had long before you got to the end of the game. And by the time you got to the end of the game, you just sort of wanted it to be over is sort of how it felt to me.
Yeah, you just get into the middle, get to Tobruk, and, you know, you're trying to treat each other on the way and go down the coast, basically. And then, you know, that's a game that could be, you can have like 5 minute Tobruk, make a game 5 minute Tobruk. You get a handful of counters, you shake them up, you see which ones land in a certain target area on a map or something like that, and say, okay, these are the ones that are in the battle. Okay, you do the same. Okay, now we roll off. All right, I win. Yay.
Yeah. There's a variety of great North Africa games that I've enjoyed playing a lot over the years. The Corps Command Toten Sontag game that Pete Bogdazarian had designed for Lock and Load years ago. Yeah. That's a blast. That's a fun game. And MMP had one in one of their magazines that covered essentially the same battle, but at a slightly wider scale. And I'm totally spacing on the name of the game. But again, another fun game in North Africa, but it's a specific battle. It's not the entire campaign going back and forth. I think that North Africa in particular is one of those places where game design has evolved beyond where the classics are able to take you. That doesn't mean the classic is bad, but it is a product of its time. And I think that we've just gotten better at game design since then to make things a little more interesting. And
yeah, plus it's the topic too. I mean, how many, there are people that love North Africa games. There are people who don't, some people who don't. Now, me personally, I think where North Africa could get more interesting is at the tactical level, because then you're fighting little vignettes of the entire campaign. Yep. And you're just trying to win that one skirmish, that one battle, that one engagement. That gets you more invested than what you were saying before with like Africa Corps, where you're basically, okay, we're trying to get over to Tobruk, and then, hey, we're going to roll off and see who wins, which is probably the way 85 to 90% of those games are determined in the end.
Yep. That's just been my experience with it. And look, I'm not trying to just generate some hate mail here. Probably happened anyway. But that's just been sort of my experience with those two particular games that folks consider to be classics that just don't do it for me. The flip side of that is I know some people that really hate Wooden Ships and Iron Men because it feels like an accounting exercise. I've always had a good time playing that game over the years. Even though naval combat is not my thing, I've always had a good time playing Wooden Ships and Iron Men. And what's funny is the people that I know that are not war gamers who do have a good time with that one tend to be the Battletech players, because Wooden Ships and Iron Men, there are parts of it that feel sort of Battletech-y with the ship tracking charts and some of the maneuverability and the variable weapons that you've got on the ships that you're trying to maximize the use of that weapon under the specific circumstances that you're in, the different ammunition loads that you can put on the cannons. That's something that I've enjoyed, even though, again, naval warfare is not normally my thing. That's been a game that I've always had a good time with over the years.
Yeah, when you're like playing Battletech, it feels like you're doing an SAT, coloring in the dots.
Sometimes. How do you like Flying Colors? I have to ask, because when I got into Flying Colors a few years ago, and Wooden Ships Iron Man just gets referenced so often, whether someone's saying they prefer it or it's one of those two games is usually your go-to.
Yeah, I've not played any of the Flying Colors ones over the years.
Oh, okay.
It's just not one I've gone to. And again, with naval warfare not really being my shtick, it's not, you know, if there's like eight games to pick and choose from, the naval one's usually not the one I'm going to grab. So
I put that in the same category as Wing Leader, though, because like you, it was kind of on the tangent. Like I'm not a naval expert. Same, like I'm not a World War II air war expert, but they're both of them put that emphasis on steering the vehicle. So I was just curious if maybe also if your interest in Wing Leader carried over into that.
Well, see, something like Flying Colors or Wooden Ships, Iron Man, any naval game would be interesting if it does a good job of capturing the need for understanding the wind and turning and how that really controls your ability to fight your ship.
Oh, yeah.
And if you make mistakes, you're going to get yourself in trouble. And I think that also can frustrate some people too, you know, to take things a little off topic. There was that, what is that Star Wars game with the big ships, not the X-Wing one, but they forget the name of that other one.
But I know what you're talking about, but I can't think of it.
Yeah, the big, you have to plot ships, your movement out, and you can run yourself off the map. And, you know, if you don't plot things out correctly. So in a way, some people will find that frustrating and hate it, because that's the type of game that you have to, when you're teaching someone how to play it, you really got to say, oh, hold on a second. Before you make this turn, I would not recommend doing that, because here's what's going to end up happening. And I'm just going to come right upon you and rake you, or I'm just going to get a good broadside on you or whatever. You have to get them to think in that term, you know, in those terms in their head ahead of time to understand how to read the wind, so to speak. And
thinking of the Star Wars Armada game?
Armada, that's it. Yeah. Because a lot of people were complaining about that when they first played it. They were running off the map because they weren't plotting their moves correctly. So you won't necessarily run off the map with like Flying Colors or the other, but you could get yourself in a compromising position unintentionally because you don't understand it in your head. You're not thinking spatially the way you need to. So that's one that I think takes a little bit of adjustment in your head to be able to think, because you have to think about movement as well as fighting, you know.
I learned that one the hard way, where I had probably the most epic wind related loss in that game ever. Playing my wife, she war games. She's one of the few.
Nice.
I was cruising, no pun intended, to a victory. I was like, oh, everything's going my way. I'm just going to unload on her next turn and, you know, roll for wind change. And it just, you know, I'm like, what are the odds of that coming up? And of course, the wind changed. Everything just got ruined. And she just started picking my ships off. And it was just like, just bloody and brutal.
That's the friction of war. That's what happens in combat. Even the great, you know, ship captains or commanders of fleets have made mistakes. Not, they haven't made mistakes, but they've, you know, they were doing the right thing. And then the wind decides to change. And guess what? Now it goes against you. That does happen.
So a bad roll of the dice, and suddenly the ropes are against you, and then your wife has you in a compromising position.
That's right.
And there was a war game.
Time for the safe word.
Guys, we're a little over the hour mark as we are recording this. Once we edit out me saying we'll probably get it down, you know, under the hour mark at that point. But as we start to wrap this up, thinking back on some the different classic wargaming adventures that you've had over your time, just quickly, is there one Bill that in particular sticks out as a particularly great game or a particular great game session that you've had with one of those classic wargames over the years?
Oh boy, Mine are also new, though. I don't know what you define as, just Russian campaign. I played a couple of turns of that, and that's probably the closest I come to. Other than that, I'm more in the, learning Cataphract now, GBOH. That's the closest I come to the classics, sitting down with them. So Shelf of Shame will get some playtime, though, I hope.
It's not the Shelf of Shame. It's the Shelf of Opportunity.
That's right.
It's a Shelf of Collection.
Yes.
Dustin James.
Right.
Definitely one of those. Mo, what about you? A particularly memorable classic war game session or classic war game that you are always willing to go back to and sit down and play under any circumstance? What do you think?
Well, for nostalgia's sake, and I did a video on this because one of the channel viewers had sent me a copy of this game. You know, I'm going to go back to the classic Tactics 2, just because I have the best memories of that game, and I can still vividly remember sitting in my basement. We had a finished basement growing up, and I was sitting down there with a friend of mine in eighth grade and freshman year. We were playing it for a couple of years. We would just play Tactics too. He'd come over on like a Friday night or a Saturday, and we'd sit there, and my mom would get us pizza, and we'd have some like grape soda or Coke or whatever, and we'd sit down and we'd play this game for hours. And then we thought it was so cool when we took the advanced route and we used nuclear weapons. We thought, whoa, this is cool, man. And it was just so much fun. So simple of a war game compared to today's games, but it was just we thought it was the coolest thing ever. And I just remember numerous sessions of us playing that game and having a really great time. And it was when, I think part of it also is because that was when life was so much simpler.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, life is definitely simpler in eighth grade than it is to, you know, at 50. Right? I think we're all in agreement there.
Yeah. And it was just so much fun because the game was simple. It was easy to understand, but at the same time, you know, we were thinking we were these really smart generals and doing all these battle plans and stuff. And really, we were just two kids that were pushing counters, rolling dice and talking smack. And it was just so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the consistently good classic war game experience to me is if you've got a handful of reasonably experienced war gamers so that you don't have to spend a lot of time teaching, you can just dig straight into the playing for a 4 or 5 player multiplayer Third Reich game. I think that is really a great experience with a classic game that a lot of folks can have a lot of fun with. It is for folks that came to wargaming later in the 80s, you're going to look at Third Reich and think that it feels sort of Axis and Allies-ish with the BRPs and sort of the economic production as a part of it all. And you're going to look at that and think, man, this feels a lot like Axis and Allies. And so there's probably a little bit to that, but I think the multiplayer nature of it, the congestion you necessarily have on the continent, just the way things are scaled, that things are fairly tight right there in the middle on the Franco-German border. And then as the Germans turn east towards the Soviet Union, you've got a lot of opportunities where you sort of have to screw with everybody else around the table, which makes for a good game. It makes for an engaging and consistent game that lots of folks have to stay involved in. Not a lot of downtime, a lot you got to pay attention to. And with a group of folks where you don't have to spend a lot of time teaching along the way and folks can just play, I think that is a consistently enjoyable time. So
yeah, another one that I would add in, I forgot about too, that played a lot of back in the 80s was Team Yankee. And I love the hell out of that game because it was pretty simple. It was that first battle series from GDW that Chadwick did. And it was a type of game that you just jam out pretty quick. And it even had a step learning approach. Like each scenario when you were playing it would say, okay, well, for these first few pages, this is going to be for scenario one. Then scenario two, you have another page or two of rules. It was on like 7 or 8 pages of rules, I think, overall, but it was fast and it really was, it could be brutal too, because you can just brew up tanks super quick. And
I have 3 awesome. Of the 4 on my shelf right now. I have Test of Arms, Battlefield Europe, and Team Yankee all sitting on the shelf right now.
Nice.
I don't have Sands of War. Wasn't one that ever interested me all that much. And I think by then they were futzing with the system a little too much anyway, but
yeah,
the original 3 were all a ton of fun.
Nice.
Had a blast with them. So guys, thank y'all very much for taking some time out of a Tuesday night to come join us on the podcast, Bill, especially, you know, first time with us here on Mentioned and Dispatches. And so thank you for being
thanks
here.
For having me. Yep. Thanks for having me. Been a blast.
And Mo, thank you for being here. And I think we're dragging you back for another session or two between now and the end of the season also. So I think
kicking and screaming. Yeah, I'll be there.
Yeah. We're going to hear from you again. Well, look, I fully realize that towards the end of the season, your availability is partly dependent on where the team is in the playoffs. So like I get
this
that.
Is true. This is true. That all remains to be seen because regular season finishes mid-April. And then of course, playoff schedule comes out then. And it's on a series basis. So
yeah, on one hand, I hope the team does well. On the other hand, don't screw with my podcast schedule.
Well, like I said, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, audience, thank you for being here. Thank you for joining us. We do appreciate it. We've still got a variety of things coming up later this season, including, you know, Mo's coming back for some stuff. We're going to take a look at the summer convention season coming forward. We're going to take a look at sort of the state of hobby wargaming as a whole. We're going to look at a couple of different professional topics because we've got Connections Online coming up. So we're going to have a couple of different podcasts with the practitioner community out there. We're going to bring some new voices in on that one. We're going to talk about adapting commercial games to those professional practitioner training purposes and see, get some insights from guys that are actually in that field and see what they think about it. So a variety of stuff we've still got coming for you as this season rolls on before we unplug for the summer and go play at game conventions a bunch. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please go to your podcast platform of choice and leave us some sort of rating. We love getting the feedback from folks. leave us a comment on the episode here, social media, in the forums, wherever. We just like hearing your feedback on things. And so we appreciate you spending some time with us, and we'll catch you next time on another episode of Mentioning Dispatches.